Welcome to the NEC Apple Distinguished Educator Podcast.
This is Barnaby from the NECC ADE podcast team. We're in cozy downtown Philly, having a casual conversation with Cole.
Can't please.
Thank you.
No problem.
Can't please.
It's nice to meet you, Barnaby.
Well, Cole, you're quite active in educational technology circles, in the forefront of that, constantly looking at new ways to reinvent what you do. You're a risk taker. Tell me a little bit about what you're currently doing.
Well, let's see. I'm the director of this thing called the Solutions Institute up at Penn State University. And it's sort of a unique opportunity. It's like this living laboratory we have. It's an R&D space where we can sort of look at what impacts teaching and learning the best. You know, so every day we get to take a look at new things. I mean, and in the last couple of years, we've really been looking a lot at iPods, specifically because of, there's sort of like this built-in sort of coolness factor. Students like them. They walk around with them. So we've been looking at those, looking at a lot of open source software, especially in the instant publishing space and blogging and things like that. Trying to figure out new ways to use those tools to support education. We're not huge fans of the traditional stuff. You know, we sort of get out there and we use it. We were using WebCT and Blackboard and all those things, I don't know, years ago. And, you know, they proved useful for some things, but there were so many pieces of that that just didn't really fit together. So we just started inventing our own stuff and see what comes out. It's actually pretty fun when you can just play around and you get that space. You know, you get a couple projects going, you can just look and see, and then you take it into the classroom, and that's a really nice luxury that we're sitting right there with all those students. And
oh, absolutely,
it's amazing. They actually tell you what they think about stuff if you ask them. So
you've got a really natural conversation then going on between your students, yourselves, exploring together.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an open. It's sort of like the concepts of Web 2.0. You know, read write. It's the read write classroom almost. You know, you can get in there and just, if it doesn't work, you fix it. You know, what's the point of keep doing something wrong? I mean, just change it.
So who owns the choices? Who owns the mistakes?
Yes, it's ours, you know. Everyone gets to make sort of a decision. And that's what's kind of neat when you take a classroom environment that's real, you know, face-to-face classroom, and you throw all this technology stuff in there, and you give them feedback mechanisms, and you give them spaces to write and to explore, especially even in a curriculum like ours, which is information sciences and technology, that isn't really about web design or web development or anything like that. But if you use those things the right way, these kids go out and they get into organizations and they start to figure out that, hey, I can use a tool like basic blogging software to track projects and to use it with my teammates, you know, whether they're sitting right there at an organization or dispersed. I mean, you know how it is with offshoring and everything now. So, I mean, our students are walking into companies like IBM and they're hitting the ground running and making decisions and, you know, impacting what they do from an operations and tactical space. I mean, it's pretty amazing, actually.
So you're thinking that the kids, again, being in an environment where they're risk-taking, where they're looking at new ways to find solutions to issues that they're trying to confront, which is outside of the normal classroom, do you feel that is then preparing them in a quicker stance? They're able to hit the ground faster?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, it's not just that. It's, you know, our curriculum is sort of designed to do that, too. And that's what's sort of nice about being in the college that I'm in, is that our educational philosophy is, excuse me, built around problem-based learning. So it's a natural extension to take that to the teaching side beyond just say, okay, here's a problem, go figure it out. You know, you can use that in your methods as well, in your pedagogy. You know, you can sort of say, I'm going to attempt to do some new things and then get that feedback and switch it up right away and see what happens. So absolutely. And the kids adopt that. So then when they become project managers and they go into leadership positions in their organizations, they've already been through four, you know, maybe 5 years of really driving themselves crazy with figuring out what the best way to do it is. You know, no one's really told them what the best way. They're sort of inventing the best way. So absolutely, yeah.
So it's almost a relief. I mean, once they step on the real world, it's like, oh, geez, this is what it's like.
Yeah, and it's crazy. Give it to me. It's crazy because when they come in, very few of them are used to learning that way. You know, a lot of our school systems are set up like, you know, I give you facts as the instructor, and you regurgitate those facts in the form of multiple tests or standards type things. They come into us and they say, wait a second, I'm paying for this education. Well, I want you to tell me something. And it takes them a couple of years until they figure out that, oh, I need to take responsibility for my learning and for what's going on. And then by the time they're juniors and seniors, they're unbelievable. And then when they graduate, they come back and say, you know, our dean always talks about how they come back and say, thank you so much. You know, I'm so further ahead than a lot of the other people because, you know, you've taught me how to think, not just facts and things like that. So, yeah.
How do you... How do you find your program itself interfacing and integrating with the real world? I mean, having lectures, having opportunities, mm-hmm. internships. What do you do to try to merge or tear down that wall between you?
Well, there's a lot of things we do. I mean, from a curricular perspective, we have required internships. We're one of the few colleges in our space that does that. So we send kids out, and they're real jobs. They're not making copies for people. I mean, they help like the state government figure out the SAP implementation in Harrisburg. You know, they go into IBM and they're working on consulting teams. So, you know, that's one thing. But our curriculum was designed in a very different way. It's only 6 years old. It's the first new college at Penn State in decades, and it was sort of a startup organization. It's what attracted me to it, you know, to come in and have a blank slate and be able to do whatever we wanted to do. But we actually had, you know, 25 CEOs of Fortune 100s come in and tell us what they really needed. It was a different approach. We didn't do the, let's borrow some courses from business and from computer science, 80 new courses, everything from the ground up, all designed that way with some really, really revolutionary pedagogy. Our dean's a huge proponent of PBL, like I mentioned, and we had to teach our faculty how to teach that way. I mean, you can imagine, faculty are used to Sage on the Stage kind of stuff, and
absolutely.
Now they're like project managers in class. It's a whole different approach, but 6 years in it, and things are going great, you know. So the real world has come into our classrooms, and I mean, we have industry experts come in, distinguished lecture series, so we do quite a bit. We do quite a bit to get the kids exposed to what's really going on out there.
Within that vision that you joined in, what do you see as your primary role? What are your three priorities that you have?
Oh, geez, my primary, within the college, I mean, you know, you have to say things like, you know, scholarship and research and things like that. But quite frankly, I mean, in my role as the director of the Institute, my biggest goal is for my team to do engaging, interesting things. You know, whatever that really means, you know, that vision is steady, but the strategies to getting to that change depending on what's going on in the real world. So, you know, the three things, you know, do interesting things, change teaching and learning for the better, and, you know, maybe get some other faculty to adopt some of those ideas and to do some interesting things too, as well.
So just kind of move forward.
Yeah, you know, let's this thing works, you know, this education thing works. I mean, there are smart people out there, but
of course
we can do better, you know. And I'm not saying like wholesale changes. I mean, you know, you'd never want to say something like that, but, you know, utilizing what kids really are interested in really makes a huge difference. You know, they come in with intrinsic motivation. When you hold up a device that they seemingly just walk around with to listen to music, and you say, this is going to be used for assessment in this class, it's going to be used for you sending me files, and it's going to be used for me sending you files, and, you know, it's kind of a neat thing. And you don't think they're going to grab onto it as quickly as they do, but, I mean, they get it right away.
So within that sense, what the kids are grabbing on, what they're excited about. So what are you most proud of for them, what they're doing? Yeah, geez. Where do I start?
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes the things that I'm most proud of are the things that they write back. So if I post something in, like, and I'm a big proponent of using class blogs. I've stopped using our university's LMS or CMS tool set. And I use a multi-user blogging tool set to give my students their own voice and to let them communicate back and forth. And when I write something and they sort of give me grief about it, you know, that conflict is really the thing that, when you can get that going in a class.
That sense of trust that's being, again, between a student risking themselves and saying, look, I don't agree with this.
Absolutely. And it's not just putting them at risk with me, it's putting them at risk with their peers, because everyone else can see that as well.
Okay.
And when you can encourage sort of a little bit of conflict, you know, not a lot, not to the point where people are angry, but where people start saying, you know, I don't really agree with what you're saying and this is why, you're on the path to teaching them something. And they're on the path to teaching themselves something.
Uh-huh.
So that's giving students a voice and letting them guide where the class goes is really a pretty important thing.
So as a teacher that may be possibly contemplating the incorporation of blogging or this dynamic interchange with students, what advice would you give them? How should they start off?
Hang on tight. Because you gotta have some guts a little bit to do it, because it's a little frightening. We're doing it right now, and I have 40 kids, and I'm missing class tomorrow. You know, I apologize for that, but I'm missing class. I got a guest lecture, I swear. I'm covered. But you should see what's going on. We had an FBI agent come in Monday night and give, like, a distinguished lecture about cybercrime, and he runs the cybercrime lab in Pittsburgh. And he came in and, I mean, you know, really laid it on them. You know, uh-huh. This is what it's all about. And I had, the way I usually do it, they're all in teams, and I make one member of each team sort of a a weekly blogger, and that their job is to sort of blog everything that's going on. So you get 8 perspectives on the same event.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's really cool. And well, they were pretty open about their criticisms of some of the things that the government's doing and their perception. They're young, you know. But you know what? He made it. He requested an account and replied.
The FBI.
And replied to every single one of those blog posts himself and laid out like the law, the sections. I mean, I've never seen learning like that take place outside of an event. So he talked for 2 hours, left, and that's usually the way it works, right? You're closed off, you're done. This guy basically came back in without anyone asking and engaged these kids in a conversation that extended well beyond the walls of the classroom. That's hybrid learning. You know, that's when you get to something good. That's really
neat. Beautiful.
Yeah, so, and I've never seen that happen before, and that would never happen in a lockdown environment like an LMS. It only happens when you sort of create a community space.
Or even if you didn't have that type of infrastructure, you just invite a guest lecture, you might, if you're fortunate enough, record it, and that's it.
Yep.
That's pretty much the extent of it.
And we could have done that, and we've thought about that, but, you know, there's also something about getting these kids to write. And especially when the outcomes of your course a lot of times are these big writing assignments, it's hard to give them meaningful activities that build their skills to that, unless you just sort of throw them out there and see what happens. So, but that blew my mind, quite frankly.
Wow. Yeah. So looking at the new stuff that's coming out, new developments, Louder?
That's my iced Frappuccino.
It's coming up?
Yeah.
So when you're looking at new technologies being developed, what excites you? What are you looking at going like, wow, this is potentially mind-blowing?
One of the things from the research side that I'm really interested in is research infrastructure and supporting dissemination. A lot of the grant monies that we get, and Penn State, by the way, is one of the top 5 R1 units. I mean, we do $650 million about in research expenditures at the university level. So it's up there with the. But one thing that universities are traditionally not great at is telling people what the results of their studies are. And they get published in these little journals that very few people have access to, especially people on the street. So imagine research centers using tools like multi-user blogging applications with RSS feeds, with podcasts and secure enclosures and things to pass findings around and transfer. I mean, it's mind-numbing that these tools are being used for so many good things and that yet so many communities haven't sort of picked up on them. So, you know, the whole concept of personal content management, disseminating research findings, communicating ideas in a new way, and letting RSS sort of be the vehicle to make all that happen is just is pretty exciting to me. And that's where I've been spending probably the last 8 to 10 months of my life, in sort of understanding what's going on in that space and how to take advantage of it for sort of novel uses and things like that.
So you see direct use within not only your setting but across the country?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've recently, we're going to be making some changes in the Institute to really attack this as an initiative. And we've talked to the heads of 3 of our centers in our college, and they're into it. They're going to buy in.
Wow.
So it's kind of a neat thing.
It is. It's very, very cool.
From classroom to labs to practice. It usually goes the other way. You know, it's usually lab, classroom, and then practice. But we tested in the classroom because the kids are such a good test case for us. You know, we can get 40 or 50 opinions like that and then turn around and you can sell it to faculty then, and they get into it and researchers get into it and it hits the street.
So, and I'm also getting a lot that although you're looking all kinds of options, all kinds of development, that sense of open source, that sense of a creative commons copyleft type of movement is where you see more growth and future potential.
I do, and I think that you look at the major funders and you look at people like NSF, and they now have requirements for dissemination, and they want to see what your dissemination plan is and how you're going to get what you're doing out to the general public. And you know, if that's not open and available, you're not fulfilling the mission of these grantees, you know. And so I think it's important that we keep pushing forward on Creative Commons kind of things and really look at how IP in general, you know, intellectual property and thought leadership can become open source, you know, not just tools and software but outcomes, you know. And then we have to change that whole promotion and tenure thing so that people can actually get credit for making their stuff available widely. But that'll happen, you know, slowly.
So at Penn State, what's the Creative Commons development? Is there awareness of it?
There is awareness of it. You know, it's not, and I don't know how it is on your campus, but at Penn State, you know, universities are traditionally very protective of their intellectual property.
Yes.
But individual faculty members, and you know the whole academic freedom thing, we have some faculty who are really sort of getting into this concept that, hey, yeah, I can take the handcuffs off by just taking the handcuffs off, you know, and just putting a Creative Commons stamp on something as opposed to going through the channels and asking and trying to figure it out. It's really their IP shared mm-hmm. with the university, and they can sort of make it available how they see fit. So, and it's interesting because our college is very interdisciplinary. I mean, our faculty are psychologists, sociologists, we have attorneys, we have computer scientists, so we have this really interesting community of people talking to one another and making really interesting forward-thinking decisions uh-huh, like that. So uh-huh. it's kind of cool. So I think, you know, five, six years
yeah, is going to be the adoption
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
Hopefully.
And that's a whole lifespan.
Oh, yeah. That's one class of kids coming in and going out.
Yes.
And that happens overnight, as you know.
It does. So within one generation, you've got changed.
Yep, that's right.
Podcasting.
Podcasting.
Yeah. Podcasting seems to be a buzzword here at NECC.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. What's your take on it?
You know, podcasting is this interesting thing to me because it's sort of like Back to the Future or something, because, you know, we've all been involved with the web for, I don't know about you, but, you know, I listened to your talk last night and you sort of had these two moments in your life where you said the web and then this podcasting thing. And it's a lot like that all over again. I remember I used to work down here in Philadelphia with this little startup company that was so much fun, but we were trying to do things like audio on the web and there was no bandwidth and all these things. And everyone said, you know, in a couple of years, all this is going to open up and we're going to have this great streaming stuff. And that never really hit. You know, this is the first time I've really seen media outside of text and documents passed around on the internet in a really effective way. And it's the first time I've ever seen firms like Apple, in particular, really adopt something as quickly. I mean, we weren't even talking about this a year ago.
No, it hadn't even hit.
I looked back at my blog and I saw that I started listening to the Daily Source Code last year in like September. And for about 2 months, I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. My God, and I kept trying to talk to people about it, and you know, this, and it's RSS, and all, you know, all the stuff, and it was like, yeah, whatever.
Right.
But now it has just hit the mainstream in a way that I think it's going to have a real shift in the way we as educators and business operates. I think that content sort of acquisition is going to be sort of supplanted by content creation, and that's exciting when you have people really creating engaging content. And we went through it with the web years ago that, you know, content is king. Remember that whole thing, you know? And we used to make e-learning and we used to have to get faculty to give us stuff. And it was so difficult. It was such a drawn out process. This just sort of cuts that cycle down to where now I can ask a faculty member, hey, talk into this, you know, iMic on the top of an iPod and you have something.
Oh, we did that last night.
Yeah, we did it for 5 minutes. Yes. And it's already posted and it's already available and you can use it as you know, a teaching and learning moment. So I think that podcasting really has some benefits, even outside of education. You move to the training side. I think you're going to see a lot of it in hospitals for medical training. You're going to see a lot of it in training in general. Some of the things that we do a lot of training. And we're sort of introducing it to some of our better clients right now. And they're sort of skeptical because it's just audio. But then they start to figure out that it's auto delivery, it's time shifted, and you have it on these devices. It's really going to make a big difference.
And then now that you've added in chapter marks, I mean, basically,
yeah.
Okay, so there's that sense that up to now, podcasting has been MP3 files. We're now moving into a whole new type of format that mm-hmm. is allowing you to add in additional information.
Right. Well, that's interesting to me, and it's kind of cool the way you guys have pulled it off. And I guess not you guys, but I'm talking to the big Apple
well,
in the sky.
It's just the natural development. I mean, you've got a progression. We as users, as creators, have found these limitations has only been audio.
Well, let me go back a little bit. So last fall, I did some stuff with podcasting in my class, and I asked my students about it. And quite frankly, they didn't like it mm-hmm. because I was doing these long, drawn-out lectures. And I gave a talk at one of the Apple Digital Campus Leadership Institutes at University of Missouri, and it was one of my slides, and it showed just how dissatisfied they were with audio. But then when you patch it over and you look at, when you take audio, and this is what they loved, I took like shorter bursts of audio that introduced a subject, a case study that we'd write as a PDF, mm-hmm. maybe an assignment and a rubric as PDFs as well.
That's right.
Wrap them together as like a Stuffit file or a zip file, and that becomes essentially a podcast or an enclosure bundle.
Uh-huh.
That they took to, because now they had auto delivery of this content that had audio, it had visuals, it had assignments, and it had assessment. It basically built the whole thing for them, and then I could guarantee that they actually got it because it was delivered. There was none of this, I didn't log into the LMS, and I didn't, you know, it took me to, it was
it's
there.
All there.
It's all there. And incidentally, we've built our tools to support enclosures. So the tools that we've created in this thing called Edison Services that we have, right from your syllabus, we sort of see that as the hub to your digital teaching and learning life, you know. And you can make announcements, and it's sort of like an instructor blog where you can drop in enclosures. So I can make an announcement, and it auto delivers right down to the students. And so
wonderful.
That's really kind of cool. That's really kind of cool. So now flash forward to the chapter marks. I have my students right now going around and doing sound seeing tours on campus. And if I can get them to figure out this tool, the beta that was just released, these sound seeing tours are going to be so amazing. And I bet you the administration, the president of our university, is going to look at that and just be floored by. Think of the potential for alumni associations and development offices then, when you can walk in and sync that iPod and get that great stuff and walk around and you have, you know, your whole library set up there and you can see the Lion Shrine or Rec Hall or
that's
the
right.
Creamery or
that's right.
Experience Arts Fest or, you know, we have the largest fireworks festival in the state. You know, you can, it's amazing.
And there's ability. I don't know if I talked about that last night, but within each of those images, you can embed then URLs, you can embed other podcasts,
yeah,
you can embed any type of information you want. It's a starting point.
It is a starting point. You know, everyone asked Apple a couple of years ago, maybe even, I don't even know how long the iPod's been out. I know I had that first 5 gig iPod. And
it still's running for me.
Yeah, my parents have mine. It's unbelievable. But everybody said, you know, why aren't you doing a PDA? Well, and I don't know if you see it, but on my campus, 5 years ago, everyone had a PDA. Today, no one has a PDA.
Wow.
They might have a smartphone. Might. Everyone has cell phones. You know, and the iPod started to do these things like calendaring and contacts and stuff like that. And it's just sort of the natural evolution. And when the photo thing came out, the first thing I did with it is I did presentations with it.
Uh-huh.
I stopped carrying around a laptop and I plugged that into a projector and people were like, what is going on here?
That's right.
Now imagine doing the same thing with a lecture, dropping that right in there, because those images can come right out of like iPhoto and everything else. They come right out of Keynote. And you can really build a pretty interactive set of experiences that way. And I guess that's what I could have done Thursday. I could have just done that and plugged it in and not had to be there.
Ah.
That's not a bad idea.
Just have the students show up with their recorders.
That's right.
Neither one has to be there.
And then they could record their responses and drop them in the cradle and send them back to me, and I could grade them on the road with one-click assessment with the 5-star ratings on the iPod.
Learning anytime, anyplace.
That's right. We're finally there.
That's right.
So, no, it's good, and it's a good move forward. What's the next step?
I kind of like that paradigm. I know this is right now iPod-centric, but that sense that within some kind of marketing campaign, there was a, you know, what's on your iPod type feel. Well, it's so relevant now. What's on your iPod? Well, I've got, yeah, music, but I've got audiobooks, I've
yeah.
got podcasts, I've got presentations,
because it used to just
photos.
Be, I'm listening to Beck.
That's right.
You know, but now it's, I'm listening to my professor, I'm listening to a sound seeing tour, I'm at the museum, and I'm finding out what's going on at the Met. I mean, it's phenomenal.
Yes.
It's the uses are really unlimited. I mean, so I think we're going to see even greater adoption. And it's almost a shame that the Duke project happened last year, because could you imagine it happening this year with all these new sort of tools
gosh,
and things?
Yes, yes.
And I know that did a lot to get where
yes.
we are today, but
yes.
With something like that now, with that kind of adoption, if I could have that kind of adoption of one tool in my classroom,
yes.
It would be something, and it's something this small. So it's pretty interesting.
What would you like to in the future, what is it that you're looking at that you would like to see develop? I know that's crystal ball moment, but what is it that
you tried to do this last night? We tried to do the look into the crystal ball.
Here we are.
You know, I'd like it to be easier for my students to publish. Right now, if you're not publishing to a CD or a DVD, it's tough. And I don't know about, you know, your classes, but I have 50, 60, 70 kids, and I don't want 75 iDVD projects, because I lose them, you know. Mm-hmm. I want them to be able to take advantage of the infrastructure. Like our university, we have a gig of space, storage space, unlimited email storage space. But the tools that are so powerful, those iLife tools, they don't really work well with that space unless you have a .Mac account.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd really like to see something like that. I'd like to see an easier way for students to track their intellectual development, you know.
So we're not even talking portfolios here.
It's sort of like portfolios, but, you know, the incidental stuff, what goes on every day, because you can glean a lot about where you are intellectually just by looking at the kinds of things you're talking about as a freshman versus a senior versus when you're out in the workspace. And I think that, you know, we're seeing the increased use of tags, search as the new desktop, that I think that it's going to become even more important. People are going to start producing more digital archives of artifacts of who they are at certain points in their lives, and that's still a little complex.
And it's also crucial, just as, well, because it's all electronic, there's no written or no permanent documents. You lose a hard drive, you've just lost.
And no one really gets metadata. You know,
that's right.
We're not really at the point yet where people understand how important it is to tag your stuff. And, you know, the tools will get smarter. I think within 2 years you'll see the tools that are really powerful in open source, you know, like WordPress and some of those other kinds of things, finding their way into the operating system. And you'll have like remember Notepad on the original Mac?
Yes. You know,
like, why did that have to go away? Why, when I type into something like that, did it just become an entry in my, whether it's private or public, it doesn't matter. But, I mean, I use my personal blog that's public to everyone to track a lot more than what people see unless they're logged in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I take notes in it when I go to meetings and I, you know, talk to sponsors or whomever. I type in there and I keep it. And it's been, well, it's allowed me to stop using applications like Word and saving things as, you know, like meeting notes. You know, how meaningful is a, you know, a title like that? I type in notes and I get in Spotlight and I get, you know, 600 entries.
That's right.
But I can use a real powerful search engine inside of a tool set to go through a database and find it. And it's indexed and it's tagged and it's marked. And so I think that's going to be something that if I could make a wish, that's what I'd like to see, better tools to support that kind of stuff.
Wonderful.
Yeah. You know, and I've never been much of a convergence guy as far as, you know, the TV will become the computer and the phone will become... I'd like to carry less devices, but at the same time, I don't want devices that are sort of hampered by the fact that they have to do all the stuff in the world. So
simple, effective,
easy way to track your digital stuff.
Okay.
You know, and because I think your digital stuff is, like I said, the artifacts to who you really become, who you've been. And I mean, I think about my daughter; she's 3.5, and we just bought her an eMac. And she uses AppleWorks, and she calls it the Writing Center, which, by the way, I think is a better word than word processor, the Writing Center.
But that's awesome.
I would love that every time she types this gibberish that she makes them pink and green,
yes,
that it drops into a digital location for her, that it's an archive. So when she gets older, her work is there. I mean, I don't know if you have children, but, you know, she comes home from preschool with all this great stuff. I'd like to be able to keep that someplace other than a shoebox.
That's right.
You know? And I think that it would be really critical for her as a growing process and a learning process to be able to take a look at that from end to end. I mean, could you imagine being able to look back on the stuff you did in elementary school and middle school and high school and have it in some organized way that you could track and use?
I somewhat do. I mean, shoeboxes and big boxes and stuff that my mom has and stuff that's shelved away,
mm-hmm,
or even electronic, you know, back on floppies, old hard drives. Don't throw away a computer because you've got stuff in there you want to access.
Mm-hmm.
With that thought that, you know, I'm kind of archiving it all, but...
What's the search mechanism? How many
there
get
is
it?
None.
I mean, there's no solid retrieval.
There is none. They're all separate media forms.
And I have a box of old floppies that has literally my entire college career on it. You know, grants that I helped faculty write. You know, when I was a teaching assistant, you know, all that stuff, it's all gone. I don't even have a computer with a floppy drive in it anymore.
Wow.
You know, how do you get that stuff off a 400K floppy? You one-sided floppy drive.
One-sided floppy.
Nobody makes that stuff. I have Bernoulli drives from grad school.
Wow.
You know, that I can't get... I have all these great authorware and director projects on them that are essentially gone forever, except for in my mind's eye. You know?
That's right.
And, you know, with the internet paradigm and the way that it works, I think we're going to get pretty good at that lifelong sort of storage of information.
Transferring the responsibility... Maybe not the responsibility, the role of archiving from us to kind of a central repository.
Yeah, and, you know, why not at the system level? You know, if we're really wishing, you know, have preferences that say every time I type into Word, it gets indexed and dropped into my repository as well. Why not every time I use AppleWorks or I make a digital movie, there's not at least a pointer to that or a reference that gets stored in my sort of online space or wherever that is, my own repository, my own data storage. So, you know, it's searchable. You can retrieve it instantly. Hey, look at the project I did when I was in middle school. You know, you can share that with your kids.
Yes.
And, you know, compare how archaic yours was compared to theirs that, you know, is actually media rich and all that kind of stuff. But so that would be my crystal ball. If I could have something, that would be what I'd want, I guess. I mean, some gold coins, you know, something like that would be good too.
Yeah, well,
you know, riches and
that's right.
Wealth, but
always
help
for funding.
Funding. Yeah.
But Cole, thank you.
Hey,
this has
thank
been a
you.
Wonderful conversation.
Oh, it's been fun.
Yes.
Let me say, you know, Apple's been involved in this for a long time, and I think you know this, you know, and we went out to NLII and we did some of this stuff, and you know, we got Missouri School of Journalism helping, and it just has been phenomenal to see sort of a grassroots thing come up through industry and through a corporation, and now they have products that support something like this within a 10-month span.
Yes.
It makes it kind of exciting to be a part of it.
Well, it just kind of, again, it's tribute to all the work that's been done right from the start, of less than a year ago, of all the pioneers, of all the educators, all the students, everyone not only just completely committed to it, but just committed to trying to find practical, easy solutions.
Well, it's the Read-Write Web.
Yes.
You know, it's the community built it. And a company came along that knows how to do it well and just sort of dropped it into a package for us.
And they're supporting us.
Yeah.
That's the way I see it.
It's
interesting. They're here to support us.
So thank you, Barnaby. It's been a pleasure talking to you as well.
You're welcome.
We got to talk more.
Absolutely.
Maybe in the virtual space.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, man.
Take care.
Yep.
Podcast.